supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You may know Stephen Fried as an investigative journalist and author of several books, including The New Rabbi, but his new book, Husbandry, is a collection of very personal essays. In them, he takes inventory of his 20-year marriage, the marriages of friends, and himself at midlife. Today, we'll talk with Stephen about his new book, but we also want to hear from you. Give us a call at 888-477-9499. Tell us about your marriage, about your husband or your wife, what you love about them, and what they do that makes you crazy. 888-477-9499. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, you begin with socks, and that's what everybody's talking about, is socks. So you talk about in your, I think it was your first article in there, how they never seemed to get in the hamper despite your wife's multi-year request. So give us a flavor for the, quote, discussion that ensues.
Well, this is, this work started about 4 years ago. The editor of Ladies Home Journal came to me and asked me if I could write about how men think and why they do the things they do. And I tried to explain to her that men really don't think, which is why they do the things that they do. And she said, there must be more to it than that. And my wife said, there better be more to it than that. And so I decided I would try to write about this subject, about writing about how men are for women in a way that I would read too. So I picked something really basic, which was socks, which is why do men take their socks and just throw them near the hamper and not in the hamper? So you can look at this at a very basic level and just say men don't care about these things, but that's not good enough. So I brought the subject up to my wife, and we had, you know, sort of a round robin about this. But, you know, whenever you do this in any marriage, what happens is you are confronted with what you were supposed to do, and your wife says, why do you keep doing this if I've asked you a million times not to do it? Now, that's an easily dismissed question, but it's also an incredibly powerful question that is like the central question of marriage. It's certainly one of the central questions of marriage for men. So I decided that I would try to explore this discussion because, as you know from being in it, it's such an uncomfortable discussion to be in. And my wife is actually like a former debate champion, so it makes it even more difficult to be in the discussion. And so what I try to explore in a funny way, talking to friends of mine and also doing some scientific research, is, you know, why do guys do this? And, you know, also, is there a way to forgive them because they're going to keep doing it? So I interviewed friends. I have a group of guys that I play basketball with all the time that I interviewed, and other friends. And some of them said, you know, variety of things. Some said, well, you know, women ask you to do so many things. How do you know which ones really matter to them? You know, couldn't they just narrow down, you know, like on the list of 8,000 requests, just make a short list of like five or six and see if socks makes it to the short list? I also looked at scientific research because my wife's always telling me that men's brains shrink as we get older. And so I actually looked to the scientific research to see what it said about this. And in fact, it was actually more complex than that. There's actually a great theory, because what I got to with her was this idea that maybe men just can't remember these things. I actually like this. It's much better than that I don't care, because there's two choices. Either men don't care or there's something wrong with us. So, you know, the older I get, the more I like the idea of something wrong with us, because then there's less blame.
Takes off the hook. Right?
Exactly. So there's, you know, I looked furiously in the scientific research for something to back this up. And the one study that I found that I just found utterly revealing and hilarious was a study about the difference between women's and men's memory, how women remember narratively and biographically and men don't. But the way they did the research is what's fascinated me. They showed men and women pictures. And the pictures were of disturbing things, dead bodies, all this horrible stuff, and dirty toilets. And in the research, it turned out that women thought that dead bodies and dirty toilets were equally disturbing, which I think may be the ultimate explanation of, I mean, a man would never think that. And, you know, I said to my wife, do you really want me to have to think this way, the way you do? And she said, of course I do. So, you know, but the socks has been like an ongoing issue with us because it's a little thing that represents all the big things in marriage. And the question is, when you know your husband isn't going to do anything about it, how do you stay in love and stay married? And that's a big part of what all the writing in this book was about.
So before we explore the latter question, okay, which is a bigger question, mm-hmm, I just have one small question about the socks thing.
Okay.
Why don't you put them in a hamper?
Why don't I?
Yeah.
You know, sometimes, because I wrote this, you know, one of the things that writers do, they write to sort of, you know, give themselves a guilt, their own guilt complex. So I would say that I think about it more since I wrote about it, and there are times that I do throw them in, and there are other times when I don't. And I'm not alone in this, because God knows I've gotten so much mail from men. It's just, I don't know, is it disobedience? Is it casualness? Is it just don't care?
Wait a minute. I'll do the questions here.
Okay.
Let me raise the questions. My job.
It's your show. Okay.
So.
Men are slobs.
Well, I don't want to know men are. I'm talking to Stephen
okay.
here.
Okay.
So, I don't want to put you in a position of being a husband.
I'm here.
But just how come?
You know, I've spent years trying to figure this out. I mean, one of the things is that men and women care about the cleanliness of the house differently. You know what? I shouldn't say that. In all couples, this is what I believe, more than even men and women. I believe that in all couples, one person cares about cleanliness more than the other. Actually, when I was sitting outside today, I was talking to somebody about husbandry. In his marriage, it was him. He was the one. But I do think in every couple, there's one person who's neater. There's one person who pays more attention to money. There's, you know, so every couple divides up this way. I am, in my marriage, certainly the slob. Certainly. I can cop to that. The question is, how do you live with that? How do you incrementally improve what you're doing? And how does your wife incrementally improve, you know, being able to deal with that and stay married?
So the latter question then.
Okay.
How does she?
Well, you know, I would like to think that when you write something like this or read something like this, at least it's funny. I mean, part of the idea of these essays, I mean, I'm not saying that these essays are about the same thing as nuclear disarmament, but in a lot of marriages, this stuff is more important than nuclear disarmament.
Right, right.
And the question is, can you have a discussion about these very basic questions of marriage in a way that is funny and that it doesn't just end up with people screaming? And that, in a way, is what these essays were supposed to be.
Judith Viorst, who's well known for writing Necessary Losses, I think her most recent book was called The Mature Marriage.
Mm-hmm.
So she was on the show a couple of years ago on this book, and she's talking about she and her husband. They have an argument about opera.
You know,
she loves it and he hates it, or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So there they are on a Sunday morning, they're having their opera argument. And he stops in the middle of the argument and he says, you know what? He says, this is one of our more boring opera arguments. Says, some of them are more interesting, but this is a boring one. And that's what you're saying here.
Well, I think that it's, you know, if you are able to step out of those arguments and recognize them as just part of your marriage and not let them take you down, it's easier said than done. And I will say that I think that the people that I know whose marriages have succeeded, I'm about to celebrate my 20th wedding anniversary, I think are the ones who are very careful about these things. And it doesn't mean you're going to catch them every time. It just means that you are able to step out of your marriage and say, I mean, that's funny to say this is one of our more boring opera arguments. You know, I try to, you know, cut these arguments down at the beginning only because we kind of know where they went. Sometimes my wife challenges my memory because one of her things is about the difference between male and female memory that she believes, and I think that there's plenty to prove this, that women keep their memory better than men. She'll say, well, if you can tell me how this whole argument goes, then we'll end it right here. You know, if you can, it's just like, you know, how your spouse tells a story that you've heard a million times. That's a big part of marriage. So her challenge to me is, okay, if you can tell me the rest of this story, the basics of the rest of this story, then I won't tell the rest of the story. You know, I wish that I said that I could tell you that I mostly got those, but there is some truth to the male memory.
But even raising that question takes you out of the argument.
Yeah, and I think that is the key. That's how people stay together in relationships. They're able to step out of the emotion of things and recognize the bigger issues involved. It's easier said than done.
Sure.
And what's been cool to me about these pieces as I've been writing them is the way that I get mail from people, from wives saying they read them to their husbands. because you can't really have this discussion with your husband. If you could, life would be a lot easier. But it's this idea that you would read it to your husband, I find just really appealing. And then I hear from some of the husbands. So, but I do think you have to create this artificial way of communicating outside, you know, the boundaries of this. Because if not, yes, it's maddening. The things that we do that drive each other crazy will always drive each other crazy. The question is, how do you stay in love?
How do you cope with it? Right. We're talking with Stephen Fried about his new book, Husbandry. And we're talking about marriage. We're talking about men in midlife and how relationships develop both in and outside of marriage. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Let's go to the phones. We've got Frank on the line.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
Hi.
Well, my wife absolutely drives me nuts at times in a conversation or a discussion or an argument. If there's something that's going the wrong way, she shuts down, completely shuts down. We'll talk about it tomorrow. It could be something that needs to be resolved immediately. And it's something that she's used as a technique ever since she was young. And it works well with me coming from an Italian background where, you know, the heat of the argument is sort of the norm. And it was an adjustment for me to learn how to cope with that. You know, solve it through argument immediately. You know, the voice is raised. It's not necessarily a rude thing, but it's just my cultural thing. The way she was raised was to just, you know, the heated argument, shut down. We'll talk about it when everyone's calm. And you know what? As maddening as it is, and as frustrating as it is after 25 years of relationship, 20 years of marriage, it actually works.
Does she talk about it later on?
Yeah.
Who brings it up? But who brings it up later on, you or her?
I'm sorry?
Who brings it up later on, you or her?
Well, usually there are things that need to be resolved, so they're always there. But usually I bring them back up. She's willing to let these go.
And then she's able to talk about it.
And then she's able to talk about it. And usually I'm, of course, much calmer because in the heat of an issue, I get riled up. And I have to agree with your guest is that everything you've said so far is true about men. You know, just in general, it's such a great, poignant way to describe how guys just function, or the brain is operating, and how we're just made up, the fabric of our body, mind, and soul. It's just, you hit it on the head.
Thank you.
I'm going to grab your book, and I'm going to read it up.
Yeah, you'll enjoy it, I promise. Frank, my comment, you know, what makes you crazy when your wife shuts down, it sounds like it's kind of passion interruptus here. You know, it's like she shuts down the passion just when you're having fun with it.
Well, you know what? That's very good because, you know, I'm willing to. I think I feed off of the heat of an argument. There's something visceral about it to me that just riles my internals up, and I can feel it. It's almost a high, and she knows how to cut that off because it's not good for the relationship to obviously have anything in the heat of an argument to discuss things and especially try to make rational decisions in that kind of a situation.
Well, what would she say happens in the reverse situation when she wants to bring up something to you that you're that she's passionate about and you don't want to talk about?
Well, I shut down intentionally. My friend.
Well, I've got to tell you something, Frank. I've been working with couples for 30 years now, and
right.
This issue comes up over and over and over again, but 99% of the time, it's the husband that shuts down.
Yeah, I was going to say that. I think that I don't want to say you're unusual, because it sounds like it goes both ways.
Right.
And
I grew up in a household of women.
You
know what? That makes a big difference. I grew up in a house of men. And one of the dynamics of my marriage, I come from a family of three brothers, and my wife comes from a family of three sisters.
Okay.
And sometimes we identify the fact that we grew up in such different environments that's part of the difference in the way we communicate.
Right, right.
Well, Frank, thanks so much for your call.
You have a great show, by the way.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. So she grew up with sisters,
yes.
Your wife, and you grew up with brothers.
Yes.
And your marriage stays together over 20 years, you ought to write a book. And the book that we're referring to is called Husbandry. It is delightful. It is accurate. It's written by Stephen Fried. who's an investigative journalist, and he's written several books, including The New Rabbi. When we come back from our break, we're going to talk a bit about some of your other books and what you're working on now.
Okay.
Our phone number is 888-477-9499. If our lines are busy, please be patient and give us a call about your spouse, your marriage, men, what it's like to be in midlife. We want to hear about your male relationships. It's a topic that we're going to get to after the break also. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Are you concerned about a loved one who is using drugs or drinking too much? You may be eligible to participate in research conducted by the Treatment Research Institute. As part of the study, you'll be asked to attend up to 14 sessions with a family trainer and will be compensated for completing questionnaires on a weekly and monthly basis. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-496-7792. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
Did you ever get into a hot debate about an issue you really cared about? And while you pulled out every great argument you could come up with, your opponent met you every step of the way and you thought to yourself, hey, this guy's no dummy. He's actually making some really good points. Well, that's what it's like on Justice Talking. Debates between passionate people who are on their toes and know their stuff. I'm Margot Adler. Get ready to get challenged on Justice Talking. Tonight at 10 on WHYY 91 FM.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking with investigative journalist Stephen Fried about his new book called Husbandry. And we're talking about what it means to be a husband, what it means to be a middle-aged man, what it means to be living with one of them also. Our number is 888-477-9499. I want to talk to you about your basketball game.
Sure.
Even your
please do.
Half-court game. So we know what the game means. You described one guy who came to the game right from the delivery room.
Yes, he claimed he asked his wife during labor if it would be okay if he went and played after she gave birth. And he claimed that she said it would be fine.
I hear he claimed that was in there.
We all had a good laugh over that. But he did show up, and we needed him to play to be a sixth. So, you know, you have to have priorities in life.
So we know what the game means. Tell us about the relationships. What do they mean?
Well, I have a basketball game. It's been going on for 15 years with a group of it's a 3-on-3 game, a 4-on-4 game. But to keep that kind of game going, you have about 10, 12 guys. And, you know, a lot of us started playing when we were in our early 30s. A lot of us were newly married or just had kids, and now we've been through a lot of stuff together in 15 years. So the game is very life-sustaining. Most of the wives, you know, really encourage us to play because they know how much it's become, you know, part of our lives. It's just, you know, a hugely pleasant surprise. I mean, it's the kind of thing that most guys have in college, but you don't necessarily get as an adult. And, you know, it started out, I was working at Philadelphia Magazine when the game started, so it originally was kind of a Philly Mag game, but I haven't worked there in a while, and the game actually has, it's now all people who met each other through different people, so the game is now much broader, you know, it's lawyers, doctors, Indian chiefs, and it's just an amazing game. We have, you know, people from their 30s to their 60s in the game, and it sustains us in all kinds of interesting ways.
I want to hear about the relationships. I've got a variety of relationships with men, and some of them I describe as, you know, kind of punch in the arm, how the hell are you, relationships. And the other is, let's sit down and tell me what's happening in your life relationships.
Well, you know, what's funny about this game is that over time, and it certainly didn't start this way, but I think because we've all been together through lost jobs, broken up marriages and stuff, it is now partly a punch in the arm game or a knock, more like knock you over on the floor game. But afterwards, you know, there's a lot of more serious talk because the people do their best to take care of each other without, you know, getting too much in each other's faces personally. But you know how men don't always talk to you about stuff. But at the same time, over time, the stuff comes out anyway. So I think that sometimes men don't communicate with you, but when you see the result of the things in their lives, you can see what's going on. So maybe they didn't tell you they were in pain at a certain time, but then when they announce that they're getting divorced or that they're leaving their job or something like that, then you know. It's an extraordinary group of guys. I do not know what I would do without them. And they've been really fun in this book. I mean, this book grew in part from conversations I would have with my wife, and in part with conversations I would have with my basketball buddies, and to keep them, you know, so that they didn't get freaked out. I mean, I don't use their names or anything like that. And, you know, they're pretty honest with me. And, you know, we talk after games. We talk in the whirlpool. And I'll shoot them questions, you know, by email if I, you know, if I'm looking for an insight about being a husband or just being a guy. And, you know, they're terrific. You know, to have friends that come to your life later in life, I mean, most guys I talk to, they have friends they got in elementary school. They have friends they knew in college. They have colleagues from work who they're like work relationships, and they realize that after they're not working with the person, they weren't really friendships. And this is a situation that started out just with guys playing ball together who became, you know, close. And only recently have the wives met each other. And that's been a different dynamic. And it's been very interesting.
We are strange, you know, in the way we relate. I mean, very few of us say, let's go out for coffee and talk.
Mm-hmm.
But we will say, let's go to a game and sit shoulder to shoulder.
Yes.
Or go fishing. But we don't say, let's go sit in front of a lake and talk.
Well, part of the whole point of husbandry was to try to capture some of those conversations. I'm like a junkie for those conversations. And I think that men have them, but you rarely read about them. One of the things that I found interesting when I first started writing about this subject was realizing that I've worked for women's magazines and for men's magazines for like 25 years. Women's magazines write about men like they're these foreign beings, and everything's like, you know, it's like woman to woman, what a jerk men are. Men's magazines, you know, or men to men, what, you know, all the sexist things that men say and that posture about women. It actually is pretty unusual to have a guy who's there trying to, you know, trying to write about what men are like for women. But also, I have to live with what my male friends say when they read the pieces. They have to be accurate to them. And there isn't that much writing like that. And I think, you know, part of it's fueled by the fact that I have a lot of people who are interesting people around me who will talk about this stuff. And over 4 years have still found it interesting to do it.
It's sad that these kinds of relationships between men are so rare.
And they're so fragile. I mean, it's amazing. Men's friendships are so fragile. It's interesting to hear women talk about men's friendships sometimes, because they will mourn the friendships between men, you know, breaking up in a way that a lot of times men won't talk about.
Right.
But they know. You can see. I mean, that's, you know, part of what I like about the idea of writing about husbandry, which is a broad subject to me. It's not just, you know, sex, love, and dirty laundry. It really is about a lot of things that men talk about almost to nobody, but occasionally to other men, is it's just, you know, the ache that you rarely get to hear men talk about, because, you know, they don't want to say it out loud.
My father, as he grew older, was wonderful and open, and he talked just about that, about mm-hmm. how he missed male relationships, and it turned out that maybe for the last 10 years of his life, certainly five, I was his only male friend.
Wow.
And he confided things in me that kind of weirded me out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, he told me when he was 80 years old that he got to second base with a woman he was going out with. And I said, Dad, I don't even want to know what second base is at your age. I just assume it sags closer to home plate. But I'm not going to sleep well tonight thinking about that.
Yeah, but you know what? To have that ability to talk to your father, that's something that most men don't have. That imprints on them. I mean, I am so influenced by my relationship with my father. I mean, I write about it in the book. My father died 10 years ago. He was 61 years old, and it destroyed me. And I think in many ways, part of the reason that I started writing more personal essays was because of the loss of my father. And I do think the relationship with you have with your dad imprints your relationship with your male friends. And a lot of guys change emotionally after they lose their fathers. It's part of the reason that I wrote this one essay about the Dead Father Society, because I do think that what happens in marriages is men lose their fathers, no matter what their relationships were with their fathers. They change emotionally. And a lot of times their wives don't know what to do and their friends around them don't know what to do. And honestly, when my dad died, I felt the first thing I thought was I had done this so badly when my other friends' fathers had died, because I just didn't know.
What did you need?
Well, you know, what I needed, one of the smartest things that happened to me when my dad died, a friend of mine who was in the game, he wasn't somebody who played all the time, but he was a guy who I knew through the game. He emailed me and he said something that I thought was so brilliant. He said, you know, it's been my experience with other friends that people's mourning and their need for compassion long outlives people's sympathy. So I'm not one of your closest friends. I'm not one of the people who's going to be with you in when you're sitting Shiva and all this kind of stuff. He said, but when you've outlasted everybody else and they're starting to say, like, snap out of it already, call me, because I know that it's going to outlast it. I thought that was utterly brilliant, and he was completely right.
I wonder if you have ever thought or said snap out of it to anyone since your dad died.
No, no. And the impulse to say snap out of it is an incredibly destructive impulse. Even though we think that it's sort of a cheerleading impulse, especially in a relationship, but the need to struggle with not saying snap out of it, I think that's one of like the most crucial things in my marriage and also in other interpersonal relationships.
There's a psychoanalyst who I quote often named Sheldon Kopp.
Mm-hmm.
And in one of his books, he said, true love is being able to tolerate your own helplessness in the face of a loved one's suffering.
Yes, and that's great.
That's exactly what you're talking about.
That's great.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Karen on the line. Karen, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a husband of 35-plus years who has a significant heart health history, and I happen to be a healthcare professional, and he's especially gained some weight around the middle. Probably he's about 15 pounds overweight. And I can't understand why he isn't motivated to exercise more, watch his diet more closely, which we try to eat healthy. He's just not motivated, and it's almost like he'll go sneak candy bars and do a lot of these things, and it's like a control thing. But it totally frustrates me, and I think it has a negative effect on our marriage.
When you say you can't understand, do you mean that?
I really do. I tell them that I tell him about this. I try to tell him in a nice way that he's got to exercise more, that he can't eat these sweet.
Karen, when you say I can't understand, that's a statement of confusion. Are you confused or are you angry?
I think I'm angry.
Yeah. So, you know, do you want to understand?
Maybe, if it helps me be less angry.
Yeah, or even if it doesn't change his behavior?
Well, I think his life depends on his behavior change.
Well, and the quality of his life and yours might depend on some other changes, too.
Right.
All right. So let's try to understand why he's doing what he's doing.
Okay.
Well,
Stephen,
it's interesting you would bring this up. There's actually a chapter in Husbandry called Men Who Diet and the Women Who Love Them. And, I mean, I am somebody who has struggled with weight issues, my entire life, every minute of my life. And that issue of that you just described of the wife wanting the husband to lose weight for his health is a very interesting dynamic. It's a dynamic in my marriage, too. I always thought, first of all, it's a much easier thing to say to your husband than that you look bad. I thought actually it was a very clever way for my wife to say that you need to lose some weight rather than you need to lose some weight. It's like I'm concerned about your health. But I don't mean to joke about it. I mean, I have a history of heart disease in my family as well. What I try to write about in Husbandry is the fact that, you know, I think men pretend that they don't care about their weight and that it's not an issue for them, but you should hear them talk about it when they just talk about it with each other. So I really doubt that your husband doesn't care. My guess is that he struggles with it as much as you do, and the question is, can you be on his side in the struggle, or are you on the side of the pressures that he feels on him? I never met a guy who was overweight who didn't want to lose weight. And, you know, one of the reasons that I wrote about this is that I felt that, low-carb dieting for some reason made dieting more macho. And so at the club where I went, all of a sudden people would talk about dieting more. They would like be daring each other to diet in a way they didn't before. But, you know, it's funny. But men's issues with their weight, I think women think that men are different about their weight than women are, and they really aren't. It's just that they don't talk about it. And so what I would say is I think your husband's struggle is real. And that's the first thing you have to accept. I mean, this is one of the things. I think that women think that men just don't have a brain because they're not thinking and emoting the way they want them to. And in fact, it's more complex than that, that they want to do it and they still can't. That is part of the problem. Your husband doesn't want to be at heart risk. You know, I'm sure he doesn't at all.
Which, Karen, is part of the reason why I asked the question about do you really not understand and do you want to understand. What Stephen's describing is probably a man who doesn't talk about his internal struggles. And when it comes to weight loss, all of the research shows that it's much more difficult to do in isolation. And here he is in an isolated position, trying to do it, if he is, on his own, by himself, without the support of his wife. And when I say without the support, certainly you're putting the right food there, but I mean the emotional support. You know, you've got your hand in his back rather than around his shoulder.
It's, you know what, it is emasculating personally to realize that you need to lose weight. And so in the dynamic of a marriage, there's always a worry. And I don't want to pretend that we don't have this in our marriage, too. We just talk about it a lot, and I write about it. But it's, you know, I guarantee you that your husband's already freaked out about this. He may not share that with you. And I think the biggest issue first is, can you get to the point where he does? And that's, you know, part of the reason that I wrote about it in husbandry, because I think, honestly, it's hard for men to talk about that stuff with their wives. Occasionally, you'll hear them talk about it with other guys. But they don't want to because it's a show of weakness to say that you're a guy and you have to go on a diet. Dieting is a thing that, you know, that women do.
So let me make a suggestion for you, Karen, before we take our break. The suggestion is to make it easier for him to talk to you is let yourself be confused, that you really don't understand. Tell him that you're concerned, of course, but you don't want to fight with him anymore about this. It's making him miserable, and it's making you miserable. And all you want to do is support him however he wants you to support him. And find out what his feelings are about this. Is he worried? Is he not worried? Does he want you to leave him alone and go away? Find out. Let him be in charge here. And you might learn something about his thinking and his feelings about it.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for your call. Our number is 888-477-9499. We're talking with Stephen Fried, who's an investigative journalist. He's written several terrific books, but his most current book is called Husbandry. It's a collection of essays in which he talks about his 20-year marriage, what it means to be married, what it means to be in middle age. He also talks about what men talk about naked. Maybe we'll chat a little bit about that after the break. Our number is 888-477-9499. We want to hear from you. If you're married, what about your spouse makes you crazy? If you're a man in midlife, what's that like? Or if you're married to a man in midlife, tell us about that. Again, 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
On the next Fresh Air, Pulitzer Prize-winning photojournalist Paul Watson. He shot the iconic photo of an American airman whose Black Hawk had been shot down over the streets of Mogadishu in Somalia and whose corpse was being desecrated by an angry mob. His new memoir is Where War Lives. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
Next time on Day to Day.
Get ready to meditate.
More and more schools are teaching transcendental meditation to help students relax and focus.
So why are some people stressed?
It's not the business of public schools to lead kids through a spiritual process.
Some people say it's a religion. It is so much baloney.
Meditation means education.
Next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking with Stephen Fried, a Philadelphia author, an investigative journalist. His most recent book is called Husbandry, which is a collection of essays about what it means to be a husband, what it means to be a man. So one of your chapters is what men talk about when they're naked. I was surprised to see that because when I'm naked, I'm not talking about much.
Well, you know, as we said earlier, since some of what got this started was my basketball game and hanging out at the gym, you know, when you grow up, I grew up in Harrisburg in a Jewish community there, and, you know, when you're a kid there, you listen to the old guys in the steam room, and this is like a very romantic notion and an idea of what it's going to be like to be a grown-up guy, to be one of those guys. So I definitely grew up with that imprint. And I have found as I got older that you hear just totally different discussions from people when they're naked. Guys are, I mean, to say that they're revealed is sort of a cliche, but there is a different dynamic around the gym and in the locker room and in the, you know, whirlpool. And so I try to pay attention to that because it is different. I mean, women always say, why won't my man be more open? Now, be careful what you wish for, because a lot of things you hear in the locker room aren't necessarily so great. But at the same time, it is very moving to me to hear just the great variety of stuff. And I used to belong to the Jewish Y on Broad Street, so I was a great connoisseur of the conversations there. And now I belong to the sporting club at the Bellevue. And it's just, you know, a myriad of fascinating conversations from sports to politics to the most personal things. I mean, the tiny snippet of one that always stays with me, because you just expect guys to talk a certain way. And I was getting dressed one day, and a guy said, what are you doing this weekend? And I said, well, my wife's out of town. She's visiting her parents. And I expected him to say, like, oh, boy, you're going to go out of the town and have a great time. And he turned to me and said, don't do anything stupid. He said, because I did. And I regretted it. And he was a guy who I knew was divorced. And I just thought the whole conversation was so surprising to me.
Wow.
But it is reminiscent. I mean, guys can, you know, to use a sports metaphor, all of a sudden they can go deep. And you kind of never know when it's going to come. And part of what fascinates me about listening to men talk in the locker room is that you never know when they're going to reveal themselves in some interesting way. And you kind of want to say, like, well, why can't you do this more often? Which I think men struggle with anyway. They ask themselves that. You know, what format is there that I would be able to be this open to my wife? You know, so I think that women have the struggle and they talk about it with other women as if the men don't care. See, but I think the men do care and they can't necessarily express that to their wives to get to the point where you can make that kind of communication. I mean, my wife and I work really hard at that. I mean, we're communicators. We're both writers. For the last 4 years, on top of everything else, we've been editing these pieces. And writing these pieces is very much about our marriage. I mean, I write a first draft. I sort of, you know, ceremoniously carry it up to my wife's office. She edits it, and I sit in the stairwell listening to see if she laughs, because her laughing at things that I wrote about our marriage is like, you know, that's one of the great joys of my life. But she doesn't always laugh. And then we will have discussions that will often be like, you think this is our marriage? You think this is the way men and women interact?
That's fabulous.
And so the interaction then shows up in the next draft. That's why my wife gets about, I'd say, a third of the best lines in the book are my wife's. And some of them come from our normal discussions. Some of them come from the discussions we have after the first draft of these essays. So it's been, you know, the process has been very interesting.
So here you are in male relationships being open literally. And emotionally, you're naked, you're hanging out, you're talking, and you've got this Diane at home, of 20-year relationship,
yes.
And you're not comfortable being naked in front of her.
Yeah, I mean, that's a small thing that I noted in the book. Thank you for bringing it up on the air for everybody. I'm glad to be sharing that. But it is true, and I don't really understand it, but I mean, I do think that one of the things that I've always been interested in writing about, and I've been writing about this subject for a number of years, starting at Glamour magazine where I work, about men and their bodies. I mean, men's attitudes toward their bodies are much more complicated than women really understand. So all I can tell you is that I don't understand why that's true, and how over the years I've gotten more comfortable, you know, in the locker room. But I am definitely sheepish, you know, around my wife. And if you see me at the beach, I'm the guy wearing like a shirt when it's 95 degrees, thinking that if I have a soaking wet shirt on, then no one can see what I look like under the shirt.
Well, I'll tell you why I brought it up.
Okay.
It was a punch in the arm.
Mm-hmm.
It was that kind of thing, you know? It was a locker room thing.
Yeah. Hey, that's you know, that's part of the way that men communicate, which I think is great.
Yeah, it's the way we play with each other. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Tamara on the line. Tamara?
Yes.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm actually not married, but I wanted to. I'm in the age range where it seems like 35 to 40 is men are having a quote-unquote midlife crisis.
Midlife crisis starts whenever you want, you know.
I'm sorry?
I said men can start their midlife crisis really whenever they want. I think it's running from 30 to, like, question mark now.
Okay. And what do you think that's due to? Is it a lack of socialization when they're younger, or?
You know, I wrote about that, and I've written about it several times in husbandry, because it's one of the essential issues. You know, one of the questions is a midlife crisis something that happens to you biologically, mm-hmm. and it's just something that comes naturally, like menopause? Or is it something that you create by asking yourself, did my midlife crisis start yet? Is this it? Is this it? Which I think both things happen with men. I actually, when I started thinking about midlife issues, I started asking everybody what they thought the early signs of midlife crisis was. And my favorite one was, I asked the woman at the video store where I rent, you know, what movies men rent when they start having their midlife crisis. And she, you know, she said, well, I'll tell you about my husband and his midlife crisis. You know, for the last 10 years, it's all horror movies with people, you know, chopping their heads off, and movies that have discreet nudity in them, because he's been sort of become an expert in Helen Hunt's nipples and other signs like that. But, you know, what I would say is that every guy is different, and guys are taught to watch for the warning signs depending on what they saw in their own lives. If their father had midlife crises that blew up their relationships, you know, so it's not just the guy himself. I mean, a lot of times what guys do, because they are not in such great touch with their own emotions, is they tend to look for things that are repeated behaviors of what their fathers did, what their uncles did, what other people around them did, because all they know is the result. I remember when I was 35 that this happened, and, you know, my dad bought this sports car and nothing was quite the same. So I think that there's no easy answer to why this happens, and I think a lot of stuff gets blamed on midlife crisis, which are really just communications issues in relationships that are always there. We just notice them in midlife. So it's real easy to blame midlife for everything. And guys do that. I'm not trying to pretend that they don't. But there's a pretty big learning curve in relationships. There's a pretty big learning curve in how men come to understand women. I think we toss everything onto the midlife issue like it's the question and the answer for everything.
Well, I'll tell you, my first symptom of midlife came at my, I think it was 30th birthday.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, I said, wow, according to actuarial tables,
mm-hmm.
I'm almost halfway done my life. And, I mean, that just shook me up, because I thought I was still a kid, and of course, I was.
Well, see, you know what? There's two kinds of guys. They're the birthday guys. I am not a birthday guy. I mean, I love birthdays, but I don't fear birthdays. I have friends and relatives where the man is like, when a birthday comes, it's like a signal to him to be freaked out. I was never like that. To me, birthdays are fun. I mean, I'm heading towards 50. Maybe I'll get hit over the head by one. But I know men that, like clockwork, their birthdays are unbearable for their wives. They're just like, I can't wait for this to be over, because there's nothing about marking this year that is fun.
Well, that's one of the themes I see with guys who are struggling with midlife. And I've got to buy a sample. I see them in my office.
Sure.
But the theme I see consistently is, I'm going to die. And what do I want to do? Is this what I want to do between now and the time I die? And usually the answer is no. I want to do something different. Or really the answer is, I don't want to die.
You know, I think that everybody, once again, I do think you get imprinted this in a certain way. And one of the things that's true for me, which may be different than some men, my dad had a heart attack when he was 29 in the 60s, when you didn't survive heart attacks. So my dad was fatalistic, but he also believed that you sort of get everything out of life, and he was never panicked because he saw every minute he had as extra time. And that's a great role model to have, and it's not the kind of role model necessarily that most men have. I think it's actually why a lot of my friends loved my dad, because he was a different kind of guy for his generation because of that. But most people, males, their role models are men that had those kinds of fear wake-up calls because of age, so that they're told that's what they're supposed to do.
The gift is, once you get over the fear of dying and that dying becomes a fact,
mm-hmm.
then you wind up where your father did.
Yeah, you know, no, my father, you know, I try to write about my relationship with my dad in the book because I learned a lot from it, even though I think that there are certain aspects of it that are unique. And part of what I tried to do in husbandry as I wrote these pieces was always look at what's interesting about my own experience, what is unusual, and separate that out from the things that are universal, because that's really how you can write for people about just a variety of issues and still have them communicate with it, even though your experience may not be the same as theirs.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Edgar on the line. Edgar?
Hello.
Hi, you're on.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes.
I'm calling up because I simply want to brag a little, if you'll forgive me for bragging. I have just returned from a weekend celebration hosted by my youngest of four daughters, the other three coming from Michigan, Vermont, and Maryland to help my wife and me celebrate our 60th wedding anniversary.
Mazel tov.
And it's been golden all the way, and I'm interested to hear these other comments by the other gentlemen, but I'm feeling so darn good after this weekend. It was a terrific, terrific weekend, and I just thought I would share with you all the fact that having a 60th wedding anniversary is not all bad.
Well, listen, Edgar, with all due respect for my guest, Stephen Fried, at this moment, I'd rather hear from you a little bit.
Me too. So, how'd you do it?
Yeah.
Well, we had a World War II romance. We had four dates before I had to sail for the fighting in Europe. I was lucky, very lucky, to survive 9 months of combat. Came back and met her briefly before my division was to go on to the Japanese invasion, which we were supposed to spearhead. And President Truman suddenly dropped the bomb, and we realized that we would no longer have to consider about going to Japan. And we got married, and it's been golden. We had four daughters. My wife is terrific. She brought up the girls very well. I was out working in the marts of trade trying to bring in a book. And we just got along fine, and we're crazy about each other, and we still are crazy about each other. One of my daughters surprised us with an album gift. She collected photographs of us all throughout our life, even before our marriage. It gave us this book of photographs as an anniversary present, which was perfectly delightful. Everybody had a fun sitting time looking at the old photographs, which they'd seen before, but we enjoyed them all over again.
How wonderful.
You know, it's funny. Something you said really reminded me that one of the things that's been interesting to me about writing about husbandry is that how surprised people are to hear men say they love their wives, which I don't know why this is so surprising and so stunning to people, but it is apparently doesn't happen as much as I would expect. Because one of the things that I've noticed as I've written essays about marriage all through my life is how surprised women are to hear a guy say that he loves his wife. And I don't know why it's surprising, but it's been very interesting to me. My wife often comments about this, how I don't think men don't love their wives. They must not say it very much, and they must be afraid to say it around other men. But it is an important thing to say, and I'm always reminded of how rare it is to hear a guy of any age say that out loud in a way that is convincing and not half-joking.
Yeah, it is sad, and it's pretty easy to say, and boy, it does an awful lot of good for one and the person they love. Edgar, thank you so much for your call. I appreciate it. I'm sure many of our listeners
congratulations, Edgar. Too.
Wish you the best. Let's go to Anita. Anita? Hi.
Hello?
Yes,
hi.
So thank you for taking my call. I've been married for almost 24 years. I'm 47. My husband will be turning 50 this year.
Mm-hmm.
And I've noticed over the years that he has become much less patient and much more businesslike in the family relationship with both myself, our relationship, and with our children. And I also noticed that things like, I guess my primary question is, it has to do with, for instance, anything that I do, he can always do faster, better, he's more efficient, et cetera. Like, for instance, if I go, you know, run some errands, I made a four-stop trip yesterday, took an hour and a quarter, and he said he could have done that in half the time.
Anita, let me cut you off because we have a bad connection. But I have one specific question. Is this a recent change in your husband, or was he always this way?
I would say it's the thing about how he's always more efficient or can do things better has always been there.
What's been the change?
I would say in the last 10 years, it has escalated. I feel like I'm always under constant critique that, you know, I'm just, you know, I'm not getting it all done or not getting it all done perfectly, according to him.
I hear you.
That he could do everything I do, he could
all right, we're gonna,
do it
we're gonna,
half the time.
All right. Well, thanks for your call. Let me just suggest this, that when you see that kind of change in a spouse and in anybody you love, it means they're unhappy with whatever is going on in their lives. They're unhappy. It could be work, it could be his own psychology, it could be his marriage. But when you find somebody doing that, they're unhappy. It could be depression, and it could be midlife. Whatever.
Well,
that
you know what? It's an incremental thing. I actually wrote about this in Husbandry because I noticed it in myself. Maybe not to the point. I think that when you let these things go, they get worse. But I do think, and I've seen this in other men, I do think that after part of midlife crisis is to become more impatient. And the question is what you do about that. Now, when that happened with my father, I thought it was physiological. I thought it was because of his heart condition. But then you know what? When I started getting into my 40s, I found myself doing some of the same things. And I wrote about that because I was asking myself the same question. And my wife was saying, you know, as nicely as possible, you know, you're a little like touchier than you used to be. And so, you know, one of the issues is whether you can you diffuse that. Because I do think it's real. And I bet that the guys that I know aren't happy that it's real. So some of it, you can get to the point before it's huge depression and sort of deadly dangerous.
And knowing it helps a great deal. Stephen Fried, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
It was lots of fun. Stephen Fried is the author of Husbandry, along with many other wonderful books. This Wednesday, September 19th, I'll be speaking at the International Meeting on Pediatric Quadriplegia at Shriners Hospital here in Philadelphia. For more information, visit my webpage at drdangottlieb.com. You can reach us at voices@whyy.org. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Shane Ewing is our intern. Christine Dempsey is our executive producer, while Elisa Walters is our associate producer. Voices in the Family is produced by Mike and Scott. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Enjoy your week, my friends.
Day to day.